Hey folks, hope all is well. This is Jim Carl saying hello and welcome you to the latest Bantercast. Bantercast is a weekly podcast from the team behind the Banter series of talks and events. At Banter, we put on events in spaces and venues of all sizes where people tell stories, talk about their lives and discuss various topics and themes. We record what happens in the room and then we podcast the results. We are chuffed to bits to welcome Micheál Amirhertig to the 150th Banter that took place in the Yacht Pub in Ringsend as part of No Idle Day, a festival from the fine people at Young Hearts Run Free. Young Hearts Run Free run various events around the city in aid of the Simon community, and No Idle Day was a festival, a biannual festival that they put on. Micheál Amirhertig, do we really need to introduce him? He is a legendary sports broadcaster, and he joined us to talk about some memories from the past, some amazing players he'd seen, some incredible matches, and much more besides.
Thanks very much, Siobhan, and thanks to everyone here for coming down to No Idle Day. Young Hearts Run Free have been running events like this for quite some time. All the money raised goes to Simon Community, so it's always a pleasure to help her out. She's amazing at getting people going, getting people together, so it's great to be here. But like, I'm particularly proud that for Banter 150, we have persuaded this man here. He is to Gaelic Games Broadcasting what Jimi Hendrix is to electric guitar. Please welcome Micheál Amirhertig.
I think Jim has drink taken.
That's one thing you and me have in common. We don't touch the demon drink. I know. On the way down here, I was passing Shelburne Park, and I thought to myself, "You're a man who has got a good history with the dogs, haven't you?"
Shelburne Park. The first time I came to Dublin, it was 1948. My first stop, Croke Park. Second stop, Shelburne Park. And I backed a winner there, and you know, when you back your first winner in a particular track, you don't forget it. The dog's name was the Grand Champion. He was a Kilkenny dog. He wasn't a hurdler, but he was a runner. And the younger people here would not remember the time when there used to be speed racing every... Speed, Ronnie Moore. Yeah, they were there for a good number of years and drew huge crowds every Sunday. So I was often at that when there wasn't a big GAA match on. I'd come down here to the Speedway. It was Speedway racing, they called it, wasn't it?
Tigers.
Well, I'd...
Eddie Rossio and
I won't contradict anyone in here.
So that was 1948.
48, yeah.
Right. So then you were back. Your first, I suppose, professional engagement, let's say, in Croke Park was the following year, wasn't it? 1949.
1949, the month of March, 1949.
Right. You said that at the time, you said like it was the best individual display you ever saw in Croke Park. A guy called Dara Hurley. Why was Dara Hurley so special, Micheál?
Well, now I said the best individual display, but he never touched the slither during the whole spell that I was on. It happened to be that Radio Éireann, as it was at the time, they put notices in different places, in UCD, in different colleges, asking people who had an interest in broadcasting matches now and again through the medium of Irish to come to Croke Park the following Sunday, free admission in Style 5. That was very attractive to a student. And so on, and that we'd all get a go. So about 10 of us went, and others came from different institutions, and it was two club matches that were on. So Ted Hurley was the man's name. Now, he was playing in goal for UCD Hurlers, and I happened to know him because he went to school 2-3 years ahead of me. How come there was a hurler down in West Kerry? His father was a bank manager in Cork and in Tipperary and their hurling counties. Nobody knew while he was in England that he could hurl. But once he came to college here, became a doctor, he was a good hurler. He was playing in goal. I didn't know anybody else.
You hadn't commentated on a hurling game before, had you?
I hadn't seen a hurling game before that. It was all football in Kerry. But those that were adjudicating and deciding they'd pick one at the end to take on the job, I knew they couldn't see the pitch. They were, for all the world, like they'd be in here now, underneath the old Hogan stand that was there since the Olympic Games in Paris in 1924. The GA invited the athletes from Paris on their way home to American places, would they compete in Croke Park. And they built a stand in expectation, and they did come. It was amateur sport at the time. So they were in under that. They could see nothing, but the sound came into them. Now, when my turn came, I was given a sheet of paper, names, I knew one. And even though the Schlitter was on the other side of the field, it was an adventure to me. It was fun. It was excitement. A time to let your imagination run. Even though the Schlitter was down near Hill 16, Ted Hurley was in the other goal, but in my description, he was pulling off the best save that was ever in Croke Park at that moment. And cleared it out. Again, it was all in the mind. Cusack sand side of the field, it was deflected out over the line. A line ball, but it was deflected out, so it was a line ball for UCD. And who was called out to take it? My friend Ted Hurley. Took a brilliant one down towards the other goal where there was a dreadful foul on the UCD full forward. The Schlitter at this stage was on the other side of the field. But he made a slow move down to take the 14 and he scored the goal. So mine went off, and in dull moments, I mentioned, you know, his brother, Robert, whom I knew well, and his two sisters who used to swim in the same place as I used to swim. And we were all supposed to get 5 minutes. I was given 20 minutes and the other was told, go home. Now, that's how I started. A complete chance, looked upon it as an adventure. And I was asked there and then, would I be willing to broadcast the Railway Cup football final the following Thursday, St. Patrick's Day, which I said, why not? Yeah. And I've been fooling the public ever since.
I mean, that's
and, there'd be Dublin followers here.
Oh, yeah.
That was St. Patrick's Day in 1949. At 19 years of age, you all heard of Heffo, Kevin Heffernan. At 19 years of age, he alone was not good enough to be captain of Vincent's on the Dublin team. He was selected on the Leinster team at 19 years of age. And you could say he spent the rest of his life involved in football. I know Kevin very well. He was often down there. He used to own dogs as well and knocked a great kick out of them. We never tried to measure did we win or lose. That could be embarrassing, you know, because most dogs and racehorses die in debt and the owners have to suffer it.
So that was your tryout then for Radio Éireann, yeah. As was, you know. And I'm curious about, like, I mean, your own immersion in radio. I mean, am I right in thinking that radio didn't arrive in your house until late on? It was your Auntie May from America or something?
Yeah, that didn't arrive. Well, radio was very scarce at that time. RTE as it is now, it was Radio Éireann. When it was founded, or when it went on air for the first time on the 1st of January 1926... Douglas Hyde was the first man that spoke on it. It was on air, I'd say, for 3 hours a day. But not everyone had a wireless. But every post office had one. And every barracks had one. And people that had none, and that was the majority of people, they'd go to those places and they'd be very welcome to listen to matches. But the thing about the matches, it started on the 1st of January. Headquarters with the GPO, it was run by the Department of Posts and Telegraphs at the time, run from there. And in the month of August that year, one of the people that were the very few people that were working for it, was a small institution. An idea just entered the head. The minister say, you know, that he was speaking in Ireland, he said nothing, walked out of the work, cycled up to where Croke Park is now. I'm sure they had a little office somewhere in Jones's Road that time, 1926. Went in there, and he said in Irish, "Tá smuin of a gum. I have an idea." Cadhain smuin of a thagot. His idea was that Galway and Kilkenny were hurling in Croke Park the following Sunday. And he said, "We have equipment that we could bring up here." And a man... woman wasn't mentioned, thanks be to God, we have women commentators as well now. But a man could describe what was happening. And anyone anywhere in Ireland that has a wireless, it was called a wireless at the time, would know instantly what was happening. Now that was a revolutionary idea. Anyone that has a radio would know instantly what was happening. That was totally unheard of up to then. And they said, why not try it? And I'm always a great believer, if a person has an idea, don't run it down. Think about it. You'd never know what it could develop, and if it fails, where's the harm? You can try something else again. But it was sensational. But the strangest thing of all, that was the first live broadcast of any sports event anywhere in the entire world. Not even the BBC. Radio America was big at the time. It was in Germany and Radio Francais, and it was all over Europe, but we weren't, because we were under England at the time, you know, well, up to 1923, you know, when the Civil War was over, our own government, and then it was they set it up, but up to then there was no way the English government were to allow a station in Ireland. But that is a record that RT should be very proud of, and are very proud of it. It was we instituted radio, our sports broadcasting, and look at the internet it is today all over the entire world. Bíon gach tos no log, and the man that did it, he was P.D. Meegan from Cork. He worked for the Irish Times. He was a journalist in England, or maybe worked in the post office, an accomplished hurler. He played in an All-Ireland final, captained London. He was from Cork. He was the person that was asked to do it, because he was well known, being a journalist, and no broadcasting box, no fancy studios or anything in Croke Park. He was among the spectators. And I'm sure there were times that he was jostled and he trying to explain what was happening with people that wanted a better view. But he was the first. Now, he'd a rather strange end, and the setting here tonight reminds me of it. He liked an odd little drop out of whatever you'd call that. And he just liked it, but on one occasion, coming up to half-time, he was broadcasting a game in Cork. He got this sudden urge. When we got that urge in school long ago, we used to say, we'll cadigum dolamach to go to the toilet, or whatever would have been there in the 20s. He got this urge, and he didn't know what to do, because the commentary that time started with the throw-in. You had to speak through half-time and then continue on the second half. But he said, I won't survive the second half if I don't do something. And he got a brilliant idea, because no sooner was the first half ended than a blind fiddler that far away from him stood up and started to play, and somebody else holding the cap, getting little donations, keep him going. And P.D. Meegan got the idea. He put the microphone down, ran down to him, pulled him by the elbow, sat him down there, and he said, keep fiddling here until I come back. And he went off and did his business, came back and did the second half. But the unfortunate thing is, the fiddler had the habit then of following him around, and he'd be playing half-time every day. But P.D. Meegan forgot to come back for the second half one day, and that was the end of his career as a commentator. Right. But he was the world's first sports commentator. Right.
So by the time you came around in 1949, 1950, doing the Railway Cup commentary, I assume that, the facilities had improved.
Oh, they had. We had a lovely box at the time. It was between the old Hogan and the long stand. Perfect view of the pitch and so on.
Yeah, okay. It's interesting, because one of the things during your career as a sports broadcaster, Micheál, at the same time as you were doing the sports broadcasting, you were also still teaching.
Oh, I was teaching at the time, because the amount of matches broadcast, you know, wasn't huge in the 40s. The first big development started in the middle of the 50s, but it wasn't huge then. And it was maybe when the 60s came, every Sunday there was a match. And then somebody said, why not have two matches on? One might be dull, the other wouldn't, and you didn't music at half time, you could have something else. So it was getting bigger, and at certain stage then I said, look, I'll go full time at it. And I always looked upon it as an adventure.
I mean, when you went full time, first of all, there was also Micheál O'Hare was kind of
Micheál O'Hare was there. I knew Micheál O'Hare since that first day. I know he was doing the first match. There were two matches on. He was doing the first match. He was going out to Baldoyle races to cover the racing for the Irish Independent. So I knew him for the rest of his life, and we met often, and great fun talking about players and so on.
Yeah. What do you think were his strengths as a broadcaster, Micheál?
Well, I think any broadcaster, I think the number one, whatever you broadcast about, unless you have a real interest in it, you shouldn't be at it. That was my thing. That's why I always said I was going to a match. I wasn't going to broadcast a match. I was going to a match, and it was an added privilege of being able to talk about it and hope that the people listening would learn something about it. But Micheál O'Hare, he was very thorough in everything he did. And I remember, and that lasted until the very end.
Yeah.
He finished up in 1985. The last game he did was an All-Ireland semi-final in hurling between Galway and Kilkenny. You know, the game that started the whole thing off years before that. And I remember meeting him in Croke Park that day. He was doing one match, I was doing another. And he said, I went down to the Ashling Hotel, down there near Kingsbridge, to see the Galway players this morning. Because a few of them, I had never seen them before. And I spoke to three newcomers, Pete Finnerty, Tony Keady, and Ollie Kilkenny. And he said, I was very impressed by what they were saying, even though it was their first time in Croke Park. He said, don't rule out a Galway win from what I heard from those. And they were playing against Kilkenny. And Galway won. It was the start of a good run for Galway. Yeah. And there were the start. But he was thorough about everything he did.
Yeah.
Whether it was horses or dogs or anything.
But I mean, that's one of your traits as well. You said earlier on when you were saying about the trial you had in Croke Park and you'd made up the story about what's going on.
Yeah.
But like, I mean, when you were commentating in your pump, I mean, you were it was colourful, but you also had the facts. You also kind of like knew all that things.
Well, I made my business to know the players. I used to go into the dressing rooms before the games. If I'd be going through a town and I had a bit of time, I'd drop in and see, like, I was at a funeral last week now. The Rattler Burn, he was known as. He was 93 years of age, and I've known him for years and years. He was actually playing for Tipperary in a match I broadcast in October 1949. And I asked him years ago, why were you called the Rattler? Now, he wasn't a huge man. He said people that I'd give a good heart shoulder to when they were trying to come in and score against me, they used to tell me their bones used to rattle for a week after. And he was laid out in the club, didn't go to any funeral home because he wouldn't go there, he told them. But he was laid out there, and we were all in there. He was in the middle, but up on the wall behind the length from here to the door, the Rattler was written. He was still alive.
Yeah.
So I knew the players, and it was great to know them. And then I spent a long number of years that I used to train the Kerry players resident in Dublin in college or anywhere. And we had great days with those as well.
Yeah. I mean, was that like these days, the thought of a commentator training those players would be seen in some quarters as a conflict of interest?
Well, it wasn't, because sometimes we had members of the opposition with us. We were very open, and my philosophy was that it's not the end of the world. It's a game. And if you win it, fantastic. If you lose it, it won't be long until another big game is coming again. Mm. And settle on the next one. No point in looking backwards and making up excuses. You weren't good enough. Generally, that's the reason you lost. It won't change. You can change the future.
Yeah. Do you think, you know, in some ways Gaelic games has become more popular and in some ways kind of more semi-professional in ways that like a lot of the whinging and cribbing has come in? I mean, look at all the discussion this year about whinging over the black card, for example.
Oh yes, but you know, that's trying to get an odd break from the referee, maybe that they wouldn't deserve, trying to influence the referee in. Now it goes on in every game, really. The one thing I like about the rugby, no player is allowed to speak to the referee except the captain. And at international level, and the bigger levels, they stick to that. If I have a grievance that I'm not getting fair play in rugby, you go to your captain, you tell him, and then the captain will go to the referee with the complaint, but the captain must accept what the referee says. He will not argue with him. But several rugby players told me, you could ring them the following day and get to have a normal conversation. You know, Paul O'Connell told me that the first. He says, I thought what I did was legal, and I want to inform of what I did and how I did it, hoping that maybe the next day I'll get away with something, you know. But the players, I had great, any amount of players I knew, and I knew how things have changed. I'm a great believer that most changes are good in hindsight. But we all have a natural resistance to change. When somebody comes up, no. But I like change always. Now, a good example now of how the changes are. There was a Kilkenny hurler, and he lived to be 104. His name was Martin White. And I knew Martin White for a long number of years, and I used to meet him. And he was driving a car at 100 years of age. But how things have changed. He won his first All-Ireland in 1932. He won again in 33. He won again in 35 and so on, you know, as Kilkenny people do. And, you know, nowadays when you win an All-Ireland, Dublin now will have a huge banquet sometime between now and Christmas. And they'll find it hard to get a hotel that'll accommodate all the people that would want to be there. It'll be a great night of celebration, and why not? So I was wondering how it was in those days. And I said one time we were talking about something, all of a sudden I said, Martin, do you remember getting your first All-Ireland medal? That would be 32. Didn't answer my question. We won again the following year. Do you remember, Martin, getting your first All-Ireland medal? And the following year again, we were going to America on a trip in the month of May. Boat from Cork, the usual way they used to travel that time. No talk about aeroplanes that time. I went down to the railway station in Kilkenny to get a train down to Cork to meet the lads coming from anywhere and everywhere, go on the boat to America. And the county secretary passed by. This was 1934 now. And as he was passing me, he turned back and he said, Martin, do you get anything for that match we won last year, referring to 1933? Divil a thing. He put the hand in the pocket and gave him his All-Ireland medal. And he was going away again, and Martin said, I picked up Corrigan and I shouted at him, I got nothing for that match we won in 1932 as well. He put the hand in the other pocket. Now, that's the way it was. Yeah. And usually in those days, players had one pair of boots. Now I see them coming in with a half bag full of boots, or depending on the weather, depending on the pitch, and they'd send experts out to test the pitch, what boot would suit today. They didn't have those luxuries. The pitches are better. Mm. The hurleys maybe are tailor-made to suit the person.
Yeah.
And, you know, dressing rooms, everything has changed, and changed for the better, really.
Great, and that's all the facilities and all the gear has changed. Do you think the games have got better or got worse? They've got faster, anyway.
They have got faster. Again, we all like to think, things are not like when we were young. I think they're better now. There's more thought put into them. There's more science put into them. They're far fitter than they used to be. Well, they used to be fit that time from their normal work. They never, none of them had cars that time. If you're lucky, they had a bicycle, but a bicycle is great exercise. They didn't have that much money. They spent a lot of time, what they used to call them, pucking ball. And even the same Martin White now, the Thursday before those All-Irelands, he said, I was living in Tullerone. I usedn't bother going into the training in Kilkenny. He said I had no transport. We'd all go down to the field. Everyone, men and women, and they wouldn't have too many schlitters either. And you'd air in the puck, you'd get in the middle of them. And he said that was a good enough training for me. Yeah. So times were different and they'll be different again.
Yeah.
I I think the time will come when the likes of me, Brat Gyasimatch, can speak to a player, you know, a player that maybe scored the goal. They'll all be mic'd. That will come.
Going up what Bubbles De Wire said after All Ireland this year, you know, he might need a kind of a 3-second delay.
It's excuse me. Yeah. Now, change it like that. Now, the referees are mic'd now.
Yeah.
They're mic'd to people in the sideline. They're mic'd to the umpires and to the linesmen in all sports. That's because at some stage somebody got the idea, shouldn't more people than the commentator have a microphone or something? Yeah.
But I mean, obviously, aside from the games changing as well, how the games are covered has changed as well.
Oh, they're covered a lot and analysed, maybe over-analysed. But then people like to see a good debate about a thing and like to get the opinion of, you know, some of you might have heard of the column, the Gooch Cooper. Now, plays with Kerry. Now, he's a player that believes, you know, in playing the game. But he got a black card in the county championship final there 10 days ago. And he was interviewed on Radio Kerry the following day, and I heard him. And interviewer said to him, "You got a black card." He said straight out, "The referee was right, I deserved it, and I hope it stays. It's a good thing." Instead of being complaining about it, "Oh, I was put off in the wrong," and all this. So the cards are there now, maybe too many of them.
Mm-hmm. Do you rate your kind of, like, I mean, the commentators who were there today, Micheál? I mean, do you think, like, you know, when you were commenting, there was always colour and verve to what you were kind of saying? You had you're a storyteller, you had the stories.
Well, I knew the players personally. I had no friends of theirs. I had no things about them. I had no things about them that I wouldn't broadcast as well. But, you know, things. I think as people, Irish people are inquisitive about other people. Now, whenever I go abroad, I go to a game of whatever their culture is. And I notice now out in Australia, horses and dogs, and the football and everything. Audience are not interested in much about the people. All they want to know is horses, the odds, how much is on this horse, what type of people are backing it, things like that. The football, who's dominating. They're not interested in the name of them or anything about them.
Mm.
But I find the Irish people like to be told little things about players, you know. And I had that from the beginning. I had the man I spoke about the first day. I knew a lot about him. And while I thought it was useful, and the only crime is silence, you have to be saying something.
How did the players kind of respond to when they hear the following day, "Oh, Micheál McCurtaigh said this about you," like, say, in the case of, like, you know, Pat Fox and the Greyhound, you bought the Greyhound from his dad, you know, or, like, what was their kind of feedback from that?
They wouldn't mind, you know, they wouldn't mind, as long as you didn't say something that was wrong about them or something hurtful. It should be usually, you know, a casual thing, but should give more information about them, you know. I'd know what their interests were and so on.
Mm.
So the player did. I knew Pat Fox well, and I saw him limping badly one day playing a match. And that's the time the big fancy blue bandages of the knee came in. I brought him down, the bandage the next time I was coming down, he put it on. It was on him for the next 10 years, and he won 321 All-Ireland, and he won maybe good few, see. So a lot of them, yeah.
Yeah. My favourite, like, on-air story you've told was about being in New York and buying a copy of The Kerryman and
Times Square.
Was that story true, or did you embellish that somewhat?
Now you're doubting my.
I'm not doubting at all, Mr. McCurtaigh. I'm just looking for proof.
Now, just totally true. You know, I was out there for maybe 10 days, and I wanted an account of the matches that took place in Kerry that week. And I went in, and it was a news agency shop, and, you know, papers everywhere. And I asked this man, when I spoke to him for a good while then, he was from Egypt. And I asked him, "Would you please have the Kerry man?" And straight away he said to me, "Do you want the North Kerry edition or the South Kerry edition?" A man from Egypt. And his mind was programmed. He knew where every paper was. You know, he'd be a good operator. And New York, they do everything quicker. And yeah, he shouldn't be messing, looking under, would they be stuck in there? He knew where everyone was. And from seeing them, the order, he knew exactly they were side by side. And I said, I take the two of them, you know. And it was there. I called there since. I was over last May. We had a great trip there last May. A lot of old Kerry, not old, but past playing age, were invited over. And we had a fantastic 10 days. Started off in New York and from there to Boston, to Chicago, to San Francisco. They weren't all meant to be taken in, but while you're halfway there or more. But I called in there while I was in New York, and he's no longer there. But the shop is there, and the Kerry man is there.
Right. Yeah. Okay, right.
And look, other men as well.
I know from kind of various people who know you that, like, I mean, you were a great man for taking diversions, and the list of people you know is quite considerable. Don Deneen tells me a great story about going with you one day to a cafe for a cup of tea. He seems to know everyone in the cafe. Like, I mean, over the years, I mean, you've accumulated all these people. Are they people, acquaintances, or are they people you were using to kind of get kind of information and leads?
Well, I would say they'd be followers of sport. And anyone that's really interested in sport, no matter what the sport is, and all sports are good, really, you know, they'd be the type. And, you know, they'd like to talk about something, and usually the local team or the county team or the match that took place last Sunday. Or wherever I went over the past week, there was nothing but Anthony Foley, that rugby player. Now, he was also a very good hurler.
Yeah, he was.
And to the day he died, there wasn't a day that he didn't take out the hurdle. And his two young 10 and 7-year-old might play a bit of rugby with him first, throwing the ball. Then that aside, now, lads, come on, get out the sticks, and they'd be hurdling. And then when that's over, then, OK, now, lads, I'll get my golf club, and you have little golf clubs, we'll swing away. And then he said, let them make their own decisions in time. That was his plan, which game they'd favour. And people usually favour the one they like best, or that they're best at.
Mm. I mean, also the coverage of, like, I mean, of his funeral showed as well the way sports kind of entwined in the fabric of this country as well.
Yeah, I went down to the funeral. You know, I had never met himself, but I knew a lot of the people that played with him, and 'twas massive. You know, there were as many people there that had no connection with rugby as there were. You know, he was a unique type of person.
I mean, earlier today I was listening to, like, Radio 1, and they were, for about 2 hours, they were going around to all the county grounds, covering all the county matches.
Oh, yeah.
All the commentators are sent down, dispatched off to the county grounds. You had Marty Morrissey down in Ennis. Everyone's going, do you miss those days? Do you miss those kind of that kind of commentary days?
I don't, because I go to the matches. Now, I didn't I retired in 2010. I had spent 62 years at it, and I had done... was it 8 decades? Because I was a teenager when I did the first one. And I was a few years with it when I did the last one. But I went to all the inter-county matches I could during the year now. League and all, some of them Saturday, often had 3 matches over the weekend. Yeah. So again, it goes back to what I said at the beginning, if you have an interest. I go there and... enjoy them just as much.
Okay. Before we get some questions from the audience, you know, I'd like to kind of get the Micheál Ó Maith-Chertach review of the championship season this year. You know, starting with football, seeing as we're in a Dublin pub. What was your take on what happened this year? How it went? Also kind of talk as well about what happened to Kerry, and then talk a bit about, like, I mean, what you think of Tipperary's run?
Tipperary in football.
Yeah.
Now,
there's only two people in the room really interested in this. I'm one of them, so I've got the microphone at the moment.
Now, Tipperary footballers, they got to a quarter final this year, and they beat Galway in the semi final. Yeah, I saw them play Kerry early in the year. They played very well. Now, they have a good background. They won a minor All Ireland a few years ago. Takes a lot of winning. Any All Ireland takes a lot of winning. A few of those were on it. They were in the under 21 final a year ago. They had a lot of those and a few wily veterans. Now, Tipperary is a county that has won All Ireland in both hurling and football. predominantly hurling. But they won, they have a very strange record. They won the hurling and football in the same year on two occasions. 1900 and 1895. Not alone in the same year, but they won both of them on the same day. The hurling and football were played on the same day. And they won in 1895 in Croke Park. They beat a team from County Meath in the football. They beat a team from Kilkenny in the hurling. So they have a football tradition, but the hurling tradition is much stronger and it's played over a bigger stretch of the county. Mm. But Dublin were money on favourites to win from the beginning. And nobody was, you know, doubting that. They have a long sequence of matches without any defeat. They had won three of the previous four All-Irelands. They had won four National Leagues in a row. They had a very, very extended panel of good players. And it was no surprise, really, when they won.
What do you make of Kerry's season, then?
Now, Kerry, over the past few years, they're in between. They had a great era. They've still won five of the last 12, even though they're building towards another. Kerry come in eras. They win an average of three of every 10. They have 37 All-Irelands. Dublin are next to them with 26, I think. But Dublin had 9 before Kerry ever won one. But Dublin are coming very big in modern times. Kerry, they hadn't the pace that Dublin had. They had a few oldish players, you know, a few years into their 30s, whereas Dublin had flying young fellas and plenty of them. But Kerry will always be contenders. Now, they'll be getting out. They've won the last three minor All-Irelands in a row. But the best prospect of all has gone to Australia. Now, he was... Mark O'Connor was his name. He won College All-Irelands in 2 years. Won four Munster Colleges with that college, championships. Two All-Irelands with the college. And two All-Ireland minors. And ever since he won the first, the Australians want to get him because he's a fantastic leaper into the sky. Now, I know him well. I know his parents and his grandparents even. But I'd be very worried about his knees. He has played very little football in the past 6 months. They still want him out there. He was home last week down in Kerry. Four clubs want him, but he's going to go with Geelong. Now, I was in Geelong a few times. Now, he'll do well there if the knees stand up. Mm. And why I say the knees, his granduncle, Tom Gege O'Connor, he won five All-Irelands, but I never remember him without a bandage on the knee. And I'd be worried that it's, you know, hereditary.
Mm. Maybe... But,
to come back to his fantastic leap into the sky, that is hereditary. No matter who has it. Brian Fenton of Dublin has it. You might get in every team maybe one person that for some reason he can go way above everybody else. And I was curious about, you know, why is it everyone? Practice will not improve. And then I happened to knock across, accidentally, a book written by an American. And the title of the book was The Inherited Gene. And the inherited gene is an extraordinarily strong Achilles tendon. And he described the Achilles tendon like a piece of rubber. And you have a piece of rubber and you extend it and let it go, it will flash back. But it's very strong rubber, he says. It will flash back and it will go out again with the power it had going. He says they have an extra surge that they get when they're in mid-air. And then I saw, within the last 12 months, I think, he was giving a lecture in UCD about his book. And I went to hear about the inherited gene. We had a long conversation. And I met him at some dinner afterwards. So he has that. There are others. There's a famous picture that's used a lot, Coleman Doyle. What paper did he do the photograph?
Irish Press.
It was in 1978. There was a famous catch by Sean Walsh of Kerry. He was always a good catch. It was a kick out from the railway goal. I was doing a bit of the match. And then there was a bunch waiting, including a man who was very good in the air himself, Brian Mullins. And Sean Walsh was this much above the mower, the ball in the hand. It's in a roundabout in Tralee now, images of it. But he has that inheritance. And his son, Tommy, went to Australia. He was a leaper as well, but he got a bad injury and he came home and he didn't really make the Kerry team because of the injury. But it's an inherited gene and very interesting. And I hope Mark O'Connor's okay. Australians like jumpers, yeah. Spectacular jumpers. Yeah. So he was one of them.
Yeah. I mean, obviously there's been an awful lot of Irish players who went out there.
Oh, yes. Like,
and you've been out there a lot as well. What do you make of Australian football?
I would say only three made it. Jim Steins of Dublin was the first. He was a massive man and a wonderful man. I knew Jim Steins since 1984. When I was going into the press gate in Croke Park and three gates away, the Dublin miners were going in. And Jim was towering over all of them. He left the line, came down with the hand out. I was broadcasting that miner fine. He said, "It's Mr. Jim Steins. Tom, I give him the good old Ballockley." You know, he was a very friendly fella. They won the All-Ireland. He was the chief architect win, and the Australians picked him up. He had a wonderful career there. He had a record number of matches without injury or anything. And there was a famous cartoon one time, a cartoon now. He had a bad injury. And the question was, he had played maybe 165 games without a miss. Would he be fit for Saturday? And the cartoon showed a person in hospital, both legs strapped to the ceiling and a bandage around the shoulder, and Jim saying, "I'll be okay by Friday." And that's the type of character he was. And not alone that, you'll get the people, the taxi people talk about. And every one of them, once they'd hear you were from Ireland, Jimmy Steins. You know, he had a charity that looked after young people in trouble, deprived areas. He got education for them. He did all those types of things. That's why now when you go into the MCC ground, where Ronnie Delaney won his gold medal in 1956 in the Olympics, the biggest statue, if you'd call it, around that place now is Jimmy Steins. And, you know, I go to see it every time I go out there. Mm. So he went and he was a success. Tyre Kennelly of Kerry was a success. And there was one other. He was the most amazing young fellow I ever met. He was born in England. At the age of 12, he was on the panel of the county cricket team. The family moved to Scotland. In no time at all, he was playing top-class soccer and rugby. At the age of 15, they moved to Listowel in Kerry. And at the age of 16, he was at midfield for the Kerry Miners in Croke Park. From there, the Australians took him. He was very successful, but the knees came against him. But he had a good career there. And like Jimmy Steins, as a young man, he has passed away as well.
Right. What's his name?
What's that? His name is. It will come to me in a minute.
Okay, right. Okay.
Now he was there for a good number. He used to come home every time.
Yeah. Right. I know that the organizer of this event, Siobhan, will kind of hit me around the head if I don't mention this. And you were talking there about the inherited gene. What's this about Mayo? Like, what do you make of Mayo's kind of inherited gene when it comes to choking on All Ireland finals?
Have we any Mayo person here? Yeah.
<Of course>.
Now Mayo. Yeah, were you at the final? You had their last. You had their last. Now, I know the Mayo players, they were in. They played. My first year in Dublin was 1948. I saw them in the All-Ireland final that they lost by 1 point to Cavan. But they won in 50-51. And I knew every single one of them. On their panel, I don't think it ever happened before, they had six doctors on that panel of 50-51. They had a dentist. They had a chemist. They had three Gardaí. And I think they had one farmer. And they were a very good team. I thought over the years that the people that played football for Mayo, this is only a personal thing, and several Mayo players living in Dublin used to train with us, and I got to know their, you know, their personalities. I had a feeling always that the people that played football for Mayo were very refined, too refined maybe, and that, you know, they were good losers. But they have learned a bit about that now, and they have
sure
changed.
Have.
But they're a good team. You win nothing. No matter how good you are, you win nothing without a bit of luck. They certainly had no luck this year. I never saw an own goal in Croke Park before, and I saw two of them from Mayo this year.
Yeah.
I never saw a goalie who is a good goalie coming on, and the first ball that came in, it went through his hands. Now, that can happen, but another time there'd be a colleague behind. There wasn't. Black card, penalty, changed the course of the game.
Yeah.
But they will win.
Yeah.
And I have promised them several times, when that wins, I'm going to go to every town in Mayo. I go to and I hope it happens soon. Now, they're a good team.
I mean, like, people go on about that Mayo course. Are you superstitious? Would you believe in something like that?
Well, now, first time I began to think there might be something in it was this year, when I saw what happened. Before that, I used to say it's a good alibi. It's a good excuse. But in the graveyard, it's supposed to have happened in Foxford. They were going around celebrating after winning in 51. And that a funeral was going into the church in Foxford, and that they didn't stop. And then T.G. Cahill did a lovely documentary on the whole thing, and they did find a tombstone in the Foxford graveyard, and the date of the death would be on the headstone. Man that died a Friday before that All-Ireland. Maybe if they could bring him back alive, they do. But I always liked, now everyone likes to see their own county win. I would like to see the like of Mayo win. But above all, I would like to see a county that never won before. That never won before.
But do you think that's possible anymore?
Of course, it's possible. I have seen counties win for the first time. I saw Down in football. I saw Armagh win their first. I saw Derry win their first. I saw Tyrone win their first. I saw Donegal. I saw Offaly win their first in hurling and football. And who would think it was possible? And maybe one thing I'd say about be ready for things happening. I remember it was 1980. And I remember very well. Offaly won a Leinster hurling semi-final. They had no record in hurling. They beat Laois. And one of their players got injured that day. He got an eye injury. And then Kilkenny and Wexford had a fantastic game. There were two good teams at the time in the main semi-final, but it meant Offaly and Kilkenny in the Leinster final. 1980, the Olympics were on that week in Moscow. Nobody would give Offaly a chance. But on the evening of the semi-finals, I went down to the I&E hospital. Pat Carroll was the guy who got the eye injury. And I met a few of the Offaly fellas there and naturally started talking about Croke Park. And I was talking about Wexford and Kilkenny. Until Paddy Delaney said to me, did you see us at all? And I said, to be honest, I didn't, because I had to go to the dressing rooms about the second team, the match I'd be broadcasting. And he said to me, don't count us out. Now, counting them out playing the All-Ireland champions. And they had never been in a Leinster final before. Or they had. They had been there in 1969 and one other time, 1929. That was their history. And as it turned out, only 8,000 turned up for the Leinster final and Offaly beat Kilkenny. Now, if you look at it, what happened after it? For a team that were only in three ever, they went on to play in 11 consecutive Leinster finals. They won seven of them. And there was only 20 years left in the century and they won four All-Irelands. And not even Kilkenny, Cork or Tipperary could pass that mark. Now, these type of things, I long to see more of those. Mm.
Last question for me, and thank you very much for your time. I'm curious about this because you going back to your days in the 70s when you were training those Kerry lads in Dublin. You know that's something that wouldn't happen anymore because those Kerry lads, there isn't as many Kerry players in Dublin. They're all living at home. They're all working at home. You know, but I'm curious about then, like at that stage, Mick O'Dwyer was in charge. You know, you talked about Heffo earlier on. You know,
yeah.
I mean, like what's your take on how the cult of the manager has progressed? And
well, that was the beginning of it. Kevin Heffernan fought. 1974, Dublin had gone through a very bad patch before that. And Dublin, in years gone by, very often it wasn't Dublin people who were on the team at all. For instance, the last one they had won before 58 was 1942. There were two men from Dingle at midfield. There was a man from Kilarkle in the centre forward. There was another one of them in the half-back line. Paddy Henry of Sligo, who was a Connacht footballer, was in the half-back line. Caleb Crone, who was to win in All-Ireland with his home county 3 years later, was cornerback. They had Dublin players, mostly from outside the city. But in the meantime, new teams came on the scene like St. Vincent's. They said Dublin teams, as far as possible, should be for Dublin people. And I'd agree with that. They came along, 'tis then they gathered this massive following they had. And Kevin Heffernan was a player, he was captain, and you know, he led them then later as a manager. Now, he was the first manager that had the title of manager. Very quiet, shy man, a nice man. And when they won in 74, they had gone through a bad little spell again after the 50s, even though they won in 63. He was appointed manager and they won Leinster and won the All-Ireland and they beat Galway and they beat Cork and they beat Offaly and they beat everything. But it was mainly a soccer following they attracted. And Kevin has a great story. He was walking up Clonliffe Road later. Now they had beaten Offaly, Galway, Cork, who were All-Ireland champions. And the followers thought, well, what happens now? We've beaten everyone in Ireland. And there was a crowd of teenagers at the end of Clonliffe Road and one of them knew Heffernan. This fellow will know. And you know what the question they put to him? Are we in Europe now? Now they were but they became real followers and they're the best in the world today.
Yeah. But like, I mean, these days it seems to me that like there's so much attention put on managers.
Oh, and Mick O'Dwyer came at the same time. And they introduced, you know, strict training, more training. They brought tactics into the game. And that was good for the game. And they were the leading to every county has a manager now. And I think at times they might have too much power, stopping players from playing for their clubs, things like that. But yeah. Changes are occurring and changes will come in the future as well.
Okay. Anyone got any questions in the audience for me, Hull?
Yeah.
Now the there'd be a lot of good games. Now the one that was mentioned quite a lot was the 1977 All Ireland football semi-final, Kerry and Dublin. And the reason it was the most hyped game I remember to this day. Dublin won in 74. Heffo was the man. When there were strong favourites to win in 75, a young Kerry team under Mick O'Dwyer beat them. The following year, Dublin beat Kerry when Kerry were supposed to win, according to all the experts. But Kevin was one thing, he was a shrewd man. And I can tell you that the preparation for 76 began on the Tuesday after losing 75. A priest, a parish priest at the time in Dublin, but from Kerry, he rang me in the Sunday night. We must meet to talk about this great victory we had. You'd think the two of us were playing, you see. That we had over Dublin on Sunday. And nothing would do him to meet. We decided to meet in Clontarf Golf Club. And we can be playing a game of golf and talking about the match. Went in, so I'd come in that door there now. There was a big room there on the right. All the Dublin players that were beaten on Sunday were there, and Kevin Heffernan in the middle of them. And on the first tee, I said to this man, he was a Monsignor. He's already getting ready for next year. And he was, and they had a famous victory. So 47 then came, 77, in the semi-final, the hype. This was the rubber, as everyone said. Now, it was a fantastic game of football. Only Dublin finished with two crashing goals. Bernard Brogan, senior, father of the... got one, and Tony Hannihoe got another. Now, that was one of them. There was a semi-final not too long ago between Kerry and Dublin again. When Kerry and Dublin meet, they go to play football. And, you know, they goes one way, goes the other way, and there's great friendship between them. And that friendship goes back to 1923. They had qualified for the final. It was the end of the Civil War. But there was I don't know what side, I won't say what side he was on. He was still interned. And Kerry said, "We will not play in the final until Galley is released." So there was talk and moves about awarding the All-Ireland title to Dublin. But Dublin said, "We don't know who Galley is, but we won't play either until he's released." So he was released and the All-Ireland final went on and Dublin won it. Yeah.
Were you surprised when you said you knew Heffo?
Yes.
Were you surprised when he brought back Jimmy Keaveney back into the team?
Twasn't he brought him back.
It was him, wasn't it?
Well, it was he. Did. The idea came. Now, they played the first round in 74 against Wexford and Croke Park. And Kerry and Roscommon were playing the league final afterwards. You could park in Clonderf Road that time and I had parked there. And I went out a good bit after the game. Who was sitting in, and he wasn't playing that time. Jimmy Keaveney was sitting into the car next to me. And we spoke for a good while about Kerry and Roscommon, not a mention of Dublin because they were dreadful, but they beat Wexford. For the next game, and 'twas up in Drogheda, Jimmy Keaveney appeared on. But what happened, 'twas Kevin told me. On the way home from that match in Croke Park, there was a guy called Terry Jennings with him. Terry was the best poker player I ever knew. And his young son was with him. And Jimmy Keaveney had taken up training them fellas, maybe 8 or 9 year olds. And on the way home, the young kid turned to Heffo and said, "Why don't you pick Jimmy Keaveney on that Dublin team?" And that was the idea. And Kevin dwelt upon it for a while. He said to himself, it might not be a bad idea. And on that night, he went down to Jimmy Keaveney. But it was Terry Jennings' young son that brought him back. And he was a great character, Jimmy, and still is a great character. It was a great idea. Deadly with threes, yes?
I'd just like, what was your view on the infamous Rule 27 ban at the time?
Or that you couldn't play.
Yeah. What was your view on it?
My view on it, that it was doing no good, that it shouldn't have been there.
Yeah, yeah.
But I used to explain it this way. There was an old enmity, which has thankfully gone, between Ireland and England. And when the GA was founded, it was founded in 1884. And remember, nobody could own land that empty afterwards, that Michael Davitt and those started the land war that got the land back for the people and so on. And it was the English people, according to evidence, that were preventing these things happening. And then all the soccer and the rugby, they came from England, and the cricket, which was very strong in Ireland. It was the British forces brought them all in. Now, nothing wrong with the games, but the people that brought them in. So the people then that put the ban in were the people that were very prominent in 1916 in the War of Independence and on different sides in the Civil War. And out of respect for those people, we saw in the celebrations, the centenary celebrations this year, you know, what the modern generation think of all these. Padraig Pearce was the man that first started schools football in Dublin. He was chairman of the schools committee and so on. So people didn't want to go against those. But as the years went by, they died. And in 71 then, when they were all gone, and I think it was out of respect for those. So that's one angle on it. But the other angle is it wasn't any good, you know, but, and people were still going. They used to dress up and go to, I know a lot of Gaelic players who used to go to rugby matches and soccer matches and so on and so on. And cricket is still very strong in North County Dublin. Every little small town in North County Dublin still has a cricket club. And they play Gaelic football and they keep greyhounds. That's the common thing of a big area in North County Dublin. So that's the it went in 71 by a huge majority, but it was a different people that had a say that time. The same way it was when Croke Park was opened up, when Lansdowne Road was being reconstructed. That was a great idea as well.
Question there.
Mammy's
hand up.
No, it's not. Right now. Over the years, what was the most hilarious incident happened
yet,
on or off the field?
Hilarious.
Depends on the definition of hilarious.
Yeah. Well, strange thing. I remember one day there was a craze for a while of streakers coming on the field.
I get that a lot.
And on this day, Kilkenny were playing. And this fellow was very agile and sidestepping people that came in to tackle him. And he was left them all sprawled in the ground. But he came down by the hogan. He was settling in towards the canal goal. And who was standing there was Christy Heffernan, a huge 6'4" Kilkenny full forward. And as he was going by, Christy drew an almighty scalp on his backside with the hull. And he disappeared off the field immediately. Didn't have to be escorted, and you know it was. Yeah.
You mentioned poker there. Were you a good poker player?
I used to like poker. I wouldn't say I was a good poker. We used to have great fun. We used to christen him Lord Edward Fitzgerald. He worked in the Irish press, but worked by night. Did any of you ever hear of Blackie Cohn? He used to play for Dublin. In the 60s. Now he was a very stylish footballer. Very stylish. You know, like Georgie Best, that type of player. And he was small, but he was very good. But he used to get hell from rough players, especially if he was playing down the country. But he qualified as a dentist and disappeared. Didn't hear much about him for a long time. And we were playing poker one night out in Lord, because we christened him Lord. He was Eddie Fitzgerald, but there was a famous Lord Edward. We christened him Lord Edward and addressed him as such when we'd be playing. And one night we were playing and he handed over to me about 4 pages of foolscap, handwritten, poetry. Have a look at them. And I read a few lines and I said to myself, rubbish, but I was thinking that time of the hands that were being dealt out and so on. Rubbish. And then we had the break for tea, maybe around 1 o'clock in the morning. And Eddie came again. He said, I was finished work the other night, Irish Press. Pubs down the quays used to be open for the dockers, that time. The same as the one up in Handel's Corner was open for the cattle market. Yeah. Any day of a market, open all night. But he said, I was drinking on my own there, and there was a man below, and we were drifting closer to each other. He was writing away. And in the end, he gave me those. He was Blackie Cole. He's out in Bermuda. But he's no longer doing dentistry. He's a sculptor and a painter and writes poetry. And I said, give me those pages. And when you'd know the person, you know, you'd have an interest that you wouldn't have beforehand. Seeing 'twas Blackie then, I read them and I thought they were great. That's the way. But, you know, that meeting and here, he was back when they were 25 years after their winning in All Ireland. He was out in the field with a snow white suit on him. He was very popular as well, you know.
Well, Micheál Mór Hurtig, thank you very much for your time. Big round of applause, Micheál. Yeah.
And you know that Siobhan and the other people that involved helping out Simon, they had a lot of things over the weekend. I think just they should be getting the ball the bus. Yeah.
So thanks a million to Micheál for joining us in Ring's End of the Night. Thanks a million to Siobhan from New Hearts Run Free for inviting us along. Find out more information about Banter at thisisbanter.com. Find out more information about Young Hearts Run Free and their upcoming events at younghearts.ie. We'll be back next week with another Bantercast. Until then, goodbye and take care.